And I titled this sermon, Suffering Alone, because that's what we're going to really see today. Jesus is suffering alone. You could put up the next slide there, Deb, or Don, sorry. All right. A lot of what we're going to be reading tonight happens in the Garden of Gethsemane, and I'm sure that's a very familiar term to all of you guys. Something I learned in my prep time this week is what Gethsemane means. Does anyone here know that? Okay, it means oil press. Okay? It was a place where they would crush the olives. And I wanted to put this ahead of when we read, so you guys get a picture of this and just be thinking this in your mind. This is the place where they would normally take the fruit, the olives, and crush them and press them into oil. And what we're going to see here tonight is the start of a battle. Jesus, he endured much suffering on the cross, but his suffering started here. This is the place where he started to be crushed. Just like the olives would have been, this is where Jesus was spiritually crushed. He was starting to feel how alone he truly was in all of this. Now, one other thing I wanted you guys to be thinking of as we move forward is the last time there was a spiritual battle of this magnitude, it also happened in a garden. Do you remember back in Genesis 3 where that spiritual battle took place? In the Garden of Eden. So, as we move forward, just keep all this in mind. There's a big spiritual battle starting here. This is where Jesus is starting to be crushed. So, let's start in Mark chapter 14, verse 32. And they went to a place called Gethsemane. And he said to his disciples, "Sit here while I pray." And he took with him Peter and James and John and began to be greatly distressed and troubled. And he said to them, "My soul is very sorrowful, even to death. Remain here and watch." And going a little farther, he fell on the ground and prayed that, if it were possible, the hour might pass from him. And he said, "Abba, Father, all things are possible for you. Remove this cup from me, yet not what I will, but what you will." And he came and found them sleeping, and he said to Peter, "Simon, are you asleep? Could you not watch 1 hour? Watch and pray that you may not enter into temptation. The spirit indeed is willing, but the flesh is weak." And again he went away and prayed, saying the same words. And again he came and found them sleeping, for their eyes were very heavy, and they did not know what to answer him. And he came the third time and said to them, "Are you still sleeping and taking your rest? It is enough. The hour has come. The Son of Man is betrayed into the hands of sinners. Rise, let us be going. See, my betrayer is at hand." So, kids, the name of the place where Jesus went to pray? I can't hear you, Benjamin. Gethsemane. Okay. Thanks, Misha. All right. So, what did Jesus pray? In verse 35, Jesus prayed that if it were possible, the hour might pass from him. Jesus, I think what we see here is we're seeing the fully man part of Jesus, right? He's in agony. He's in distress. It says even unto death. He's praying. He knows what's going to happen, and he's praying, "Oh, I don't want this to happen. I know the pain that's coming. I know the separation that's coming." And you contrast that. We know Jesus died as a sacrifice for his people, for their sins. Up until this point, what were they sacrificing? Animals, right? So just contrast what Jesus is going through here and what an animal would be going through. An animal would be led not knowing what's going on. It has no reasoning. It's not praying. And here Jesus is purposely laying his life down. And he knows the cost. He knows what's going to happen. It's not just a dumb animal walking up to be sacrificed. It's a man. And not only the physical torture, but the spiritual separation. Like I said, he knows he's going to endure a lot physically, but he also knows in order to do this, he needs to become sin. He's going to be completely separated from his Father God. Next slide. So these are some other scriptures. 2 Corinthians 5:21 says, "For our sake, he," that's God, "made him," Jesus, "to be sin, who knew no sin, so that in him we might become the righteousness of God." He was made sin. Hebrews 5, 7 and 8, "In the days of his flesh, Jesus offered up prayers and supplications with loud cries and tears to him who was able to save him from death, and he was heard because of his reverence. Although he was a son, he learned obedience through what he suffered." So just think about that, loud cries and tears. He's praying in the garden. His disciples are there. Peter, James, and John are a little closer, but then Jesus is by himself, and loud cries and tears, he knows. Can you feel this? Can you understand what he's going through? In verse 36, he's crying out to God, and he's not just saying, "Oh, great God, sovereign King of the universe," right? He's saying, "Abba, Father." So as a father, I just imagine like when my kids are crying and they come up to me and say, "Papa," or "Daddy," you know, he's making that connection with his Father, and he's saying, "God, if there's any way you can take this suffering from me, will you do it?" So kids, question number two, Jesus asked his Father if there was any other way to save people. He didn't want to die, but Jesus prayed to God, "Not what I will, but what you will," right? So what he's saying is, "I'm feeling this certain way. I want it to be done a certain way or not at all, but yet it's not about me. It's about you and your will and your plan to save people, and I'm willing to lay down my will in order to do your will." And he also says, "Remove this cup from me, yet not what I will, but what you will." That's kind of a weird thing, right? Ben, have you ever prayed about removing a cup from you? What does that mean, right? So, let's see here. Next slide. "Remove this cup from me." What Jesus is doing, he's referring to these passages in the Old Testament. And I only put three of them up here. There's a lot more. But Psalm 75:8, "For in the hand of the Lord there is a cup with foaming wine, well mixed, and he pours out from it, and all the wicked of the earth shall drain it down to the dregs." The dregs are like the coffee grounds at the bottom of your parents' or grandparents' coffee cup, right? Drank all the liquid down. So just getting this kind of picture from the Psalms, the Lord has a cup that holds his wrath, and those who sin against him deserve to drink of the cup, and they will drink it all. Isaiah 51, 17, "Wake yourself, wake yourself. Stand up, O Jerusalem, you who have drunk from the hand of the Lord the cup of his wrath, who have drunk to the dregs the bowl, the cup of staggering." Again, this is a judgment on the people who have turned to idols and to sin. Jeremiah 25, 15, "Thus the Lord, the God of Israel, said to me, take from my hand this cup of the wine of wrath, and make all the nations to whom I send you drink it." So here again, we just get these pictures of nations or people groups that are going to experience the wrath of God in various ways because of their sin. Here, Jesus is referring to the cup. So he's saying, "All things are possible for you, Daddy. Remove this cup from me. Yet not what I will, but what you will." He knows this is the same cup he's going to be drinking. He's going to be drinking the full wrath of God down to the dregs. And he's doing it alone. So, the only way to fulfill his Father's will is to be crushed. The only way to conquer sin is by surrender. But we won't worry because he has his friends watching and praying for him, right? Verse 34 said, Jesus said to his disciples, "My soul is very sorrowful, even to death. Remain here and watch." He's confident. He knows that his closest friends are going to be awake and praying for him, right? Next slide. What are they doing? Kids, you see that? What is Jesus' disciples doing? He said, remain here, watch, pray, right? They need to understand what's going on. The disciples sleeping is evidence that he is suffering alone. Isn't it? All the time they're with him, he's doing things with them, he's training them, and then when he needs them most, when he needs them to watch and to pray for themselves, as they're going to be joining him, they're sleeping. No, he's fully alone as he's going to go and drink the wrath of God. Notice in verse 37, Jesus came and found them sleeping, and he said to Peter, Simon, are you asleep? Isn't that weird that Mark would write that? He says to Peter, what does Peter mean, the name? Rock, right? On this rock I will build my church. And here Jesus refers to him as Simon, his old name. Simon, you're doing your old ways. You're sleeping. You're not staying alert and praying. And we will see that Peter is ready for any attack as we read forward, except for the attack from sleep, right? So, watch and pray. If Peter woke up physically and spiritually and drew close independence on God, he could have resisted the upcoming temptation he was going to face. And Jesus knew Peter better than he did. Verse 39. And again, Jesus went away and prayed, saying the same words. He's saying the same words. Have you guys ever kept going to God with the same thing? Because something was really bothering you. Lord, please, 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 right? He's going away praying the same words. And in Luke, the Gospel of Luke, in this version of the story, it says Jesus was so distraught, he was actually sweating blood. This is how much it was bothering him that he was actually sweating blood. So next slide, we're going to read what happens next, starting in verse 43. And immediately while he was still speaking, Judas came, one of the 12, and with him a crowd with swords and clubs from the chief priests and the scribes and the elders. Now the betrayer had given them a sign saying, "The one I will kiss is the man. Seize him and lead him away under guard." And when he came, he went up to him at once and said, Rabbi, and he kissed him. And they laid hands on him and seized him. But one of those who stood by drew his sword and struck the servant of the high priest and cut off his ear. And Jesus said to them, have you come out as against a robber with swords and clubs to capture me? Day after day I was with you in the temple teaching, and you did not seize me. But let the scriptures be fulfilled. And they all left him and fled. And a young man followed him with nothing but a linen cloth about his body, and they seized him. But he left the linen cloth and ran away naked. Kind of bizarre verses there, but we'll get to that. So anyways, next slide. What we got here is the betrayal. Remember we talked about what it means to betray someone last week, kids? And here we see Judas coming up and betraying Jesus. Now imagine you're the disciples and you're in the garden. It's late. You're not normally going out this late. You just had this big meal, went out to the garden. Jesus is wanting to pray. And you know, well, Judas left during the meal. I wonder where he is. Well, we'll find him in the morning or whatever. And all of a sudden, you've been sleeping, dozing off for a little bit. And then you wake up, there's a loud big group coming up into the garden carrying torches and clubs and hold on, Misha. And all of a sudden you're looking and in the group there's Judas. What are you doing with that group, right? And he comes up and he greets Jesus and he says, Rabbi. So that's your next question, right?
Rabbi
is a title of respect. It means teacher. Like almost like a professor or someone very high up that's teaching, okay? So it wouldn't just be a whatever teacher, it's a like a pastor teacher kind of thing, okay? So what Judas is doing, he's coming up and he's saying, Rabbi, he's greeting him with this big title of honor and respect. And I think another thing we can draw from this is if Jesus, like we see in many of the pictures in the children's Bibles or whatever, have this beautiful, not stained white robe with a beautiful blue sash, they probably would have been able to pick him out, right? But I think he was very normal in appearance. Isaiah even says that. There was nothing flashy about him, right? He was just one of the guys. So they needed a sign to know, Judas, which one is Jesus? Because we don't want to arrest the wrong guy, and then we'd really be in trouble. So just something to think about when we see a lot of these paintings and stuff. Jesus wasn't wearing this beautiful white robe with a blue sash. Otherwise, they would have known, right? Of course, that's Jesus. So Judas comes up, greets him, Rabbi, and he gives him a kiss. Now, this is not a kiss mom and dad would do. This is in a different culture. Some cultures, they will come up and kiss on the cheek as a greeting, a welcoming, a sign of deep respect, honor, or brotherly love. So the other disciples are probably confused seeing this. Judas is coming up with this big group of guys, a lot of like police officers, right? What's going on here? Judas greets Jesus, Rabbi, gives him a kiss, and then all of a sudden, things go crazy, right? Verse 47. But one of those who stood by drew his sword and struck the servant of the high priest and cut off his ear. What, Misha?
Why did Judas kiss Jesus?
Why did Judas kiss Jesus? Because he made it look like he was coming to him in respect and honor and love. Kind of like when you kiss mama or papa goodnight on the cheek. You're saying, I love you. Goodnight, right? And Judas is coming up to Jesus saying, hey, Rabbi, you're worthy of a kiss. I love you. But what he's really doing is showing the policemen, the guards and stuff that's going to come arrest Jesus, who Jesus is, so they can take him away. Okay? That's what betrayal is. He's making it seem like he's doing something nice, but really he's betraying him. He's doing something mean. Okay? And then he pulls you in the van and takes you away from mom and dad?
Yeah.
Yes, it's like that. All right. So anyways, so verse 47, action breaks loose, right? One of them standing there strikes the high servant's, or the high priest's servant, cuts off his ear with a sword. And we learn from John 18 that this one is Peter, right? So Peter wasn't ready to stay awake. But now he's ready to fight. He's the one with the sword. And he, imagine going into a group of cops and just striking them with a sword. I mean, this is going to be bad, right? And we also read in Luke's gospel, what's nice is we have different accounts of this story so we can piece together different things. But Jesus takes that servant's ear and heals him. If he hadn't done that, there might have been another cross at Calvary that day, right? But Jesus heals him because he knows I need to do this alone. I'm suffering alone. I'm doing this for a purpose. I'm not a rebel that's going out to beat up servants or anything like that. I'm laying my life down for my people, and I'm going to do it alone. So, verse 48. Jesus said to them, have you come out as a robber, or against a robber with swords and clubs to capture me? Day after day I was with you in the temple teaching, and you did not seize me. But let the scriptures be fulfilled. And they all left him and fled. So what Jesus is saying, I was with you guys in the temple day after day, all week long. And you never arrested me there in front of the people. And now when I'm praying to my Father in the garden at night, you come out with clubs. As if I'm going to put up a fight or run away, and you're going to arrest me here. Let the scriptures be fulfilled. Lots of scriptures are being fulfilled in this whole story. But remember the one that we read a week or two ago? The shepherd will be struck and the sheep will scatter, right? And that's exactly what we're seeing here now. When Jesus is arrested, they all fled. So, kids, circle the names of the disciples who ran away when Jesus was arrested. I wrote all the disciples' names down there for you. Happy circling, okay? Then verse 51 and 52, we get this weird thing. It says, a young man followed him with nothing but a linen cloth about his body, and they seized him. And he left the linen cloth and ran away naked. What's going on here? This is weird, isn't it? Who is this young man? Well, a lot of scholars think that this is Mark, the guy who wrote this gospel. And a possible scenario of what might happen here, the scholars also think that it was probably Mark's mother who owned the house where the upper room was when they had their Last Supper together. And if Mark's family owned the house, you would imagine when Judas left to go get the guards. Remember when Jesus said, what you need to do, go do quickly? Jesus and the disciples leave at that time, go out to the garden. Well, Judas and the guards probably showed back up at the house because that's where Jesus just was. He's not there. Okay, well, I know he likes to go pray in the garden. Let's go there next. Well, Mark, a young man, hearing this commotion show up at his house, probably got out of bed. Maybe he's sleeping in just his underwear, pajamas, or whatever the linen cloth was at the time, right? And he's like, I got to go warn Jesus. I got to go warn the disciples. And he takes off running to the garden. I'm thinking that's maybe what happened. And as he gets there, he sees this commotion happening. And the guards see him, and they grab him. He's just a young man, right? Just a kid. And they grab him, and he gets away, but he's running in shame, just like the rest of the disciples. And his nakedness is almost like a picture of that shame of what all the disciples are doing. They're not staying with their Lord. Their Lord is getting struck, and the sheep are scattering. And that picture of shamefully running away is what's happening to Mark. And if you guys want to do a nerdy little study, Amos 2, verses 13 to 16, if you want to write that down, it kind of prophesies about what's going on with Mark running away naked. Okay, next slide. Mark 14, starting in verse 53. What happens next? And they lead Jesus to the high priest, and all the chief priests and the elders and the scribes came together. And Peter had followed him at a distance right into the courtyard of the high priest. And he was sitting with the guards and warming himself at a fire. Now the chief priests and the whole council were seeking testimony against Jesus to put him to death, but they found none. For many bore false witness against him, but their testimony did not agree. And some stood up and bore false witness against him, saying, we heard him say, I will destroy this temple that is made with hands, and in 3 days I will build another, not made with hands. Yet even about this, their testimony did not agree. And the high priest stood up in the midst and said and asked Jesus, have you no answer to make? What is it that these men testify against you? But he remained silent and made no answer. Again, the high priest asked him, are you the Christ, the Son of the Blessed? And Jesus said, I am. And you will see the Son of Man seated at the right hand of power and coming with the clouds of heaven. And the high priest tore his garments and said, what further witnesses do we need? You have heard this blasphemy. What is your decision? And they all condemned him as deserving death. And some began to spit on him and to cover his face and to strike him, saying to him, prophesy. And the guards received him with blows. So what we see here, next slide, is Jesus on trial. There's false testimonies brought before Jesus. So kids, that means people are lying about him. They're putting him on trial and saying, we're going to figure out what to do with you. Are we going to throw you in prison? Are we going to kill you? Or are we going to let you go? And people are coming up and they're lying about Jesus because they want to get him killed. But the Jewish custom is they need the witnesses to line up the testimonies. They can't have conflicting testimonies or he's going to walk away innocent. So all these false testimonies are brought before Jesus, and what the high priest is trying to do is get Jesus to speak. Because if Jesus will speak, well, then they can use Jesus' words against him. But Jesus is silent. And Isaiah 53:7 prophesies about this. It says, "He was oppressed and he was afflicted, yet he opened not his mouth. Like a lamb that is led to slaughter, and like a sheep that is before its shearers is silent, so he opened not his mouth." He knew that he could provide truth and good testimony to defend himself, but that would get him off, wouldn't it? He would be innocent. And he knew, this is my Father's will, that I have to go and die. I know I have to do this, and I'm signing up for it. I'm willing to do it. So he keeps his mouth shut. Again, false witnesses aren't consistent, so the high priest tries to get Jesus to speak blasphemy himself. And in verse 61, Jesus remained silent and made no answer. Again, the high priest asked him, "Are you the Christ, the Son of the Blessed?" And Jesus said, "I am, and you will see the Son of Man seated at the right hand of power and coming with the clouds of heaven." So notice the contrast between what the high priest says. He's not even able to say God's name. He says, "Are you the Son of the Blessed?" Contrast that with what Jesus answers. Jesus says, "I am." He uses that word that God used in the Old Testament to give his personal name, his covenant name. "I am." Remember Moses at the burning bush? "What's your name?" "I am." And Jesus uses that personal name of God, even though the high priest, the best pastor they should have had, can't even say God. And Jesus says, "I am, and you will see the Son of Man." Again, referring back to that prophecy in Daniel 7, this is the one that's been given all authority over all the earth, and he can approach the throne of God. So what Jesus is saying is, yeah, I am. I am the Son of God, and I have been given all authority, and you're going to see the judgment come on Jerusalem and the temple. It will happen. So the high priest, what does he do? He rips his clothes. This is blasphemy, right? We don't do that in our culture, but in that culture, if someone said blasphemy, if they said they were God, they would rip their clothes. And they began to spit on Jesus, beat him, and tell him to prophesy. Ben, you want to come up here? Yeah, you don't know what I'm going to do, do you? No, no chocolate today. So, Ben, this is what they would have done to Jesus. They would have blindfolded him.
Okay.
Hold on a second. Okay, we're safe. There. Now imagine people telling lies against you, and now you got people come. Can you see?
No.
No. Do you want me to call people up to come beat you?
No.
And spit on you?
No.
No, yeah. But this is what it would have been like for Jesus standing there, people telling lies about him, people accusing him of things, and then they start coming up and they spit on his face and they start hitting him in the head and the chest and the arms. Wouldn't that hurt? Yeah, and just imagine Jesus feeling all alone. All his friends had left him. Here, go find someone to open you up because those are real.
I can't.
Oh, you can't grab it.
Okay.
Thanks, Ben. But kids, I want you to understand, Jesus was entirely alone. He was feeling alone emotionally. He knew the agony that was set before him. And on top of all that, he's beaten and spit upon, and people were lying about him. That would have been bad news, right? Oscar, don't lose that key, bud. All right. So they're striking Jesus, and they're saying, "Prophesy. Tell us something," right? Well, Jesus is staying silent, but the ironic thing is Jesus did prophesy about something, and it's happening at that moment. It's happening right outside in the courtyard with Peter. And Mark writes this flashback story about what's happening at that same time, and we're going to see it. So even though Jesus is silent when they're saying prophesy, he actually did it. He did prophesy, and it is coming true at that very moment. So Mark 14, starting in verse 66, "And as Peter was below in the courtyard, one of the servant girls of the high priest came, and seeing Peter warming herself, she looked at him and said, 'You also were with the Nazarene Jesus.' But he denied it, saying, 'I neither know nor understand what you mean.' And he went out into the gateway, and the rooster crowed. And the servant girl saw him and began again to say but to the bystanders, 'This man is one of them.' But again he denied it. And after a little while, the bystanders again said to Peter, 'Certainly you are one of them, for you are a Galilean.' But he began to invoke a curse on himself and to swear, 'I do not know this man of whom you speak.' And immediately the rooster crowed a second time. And Peter remembered how Jesus had said to him, 'Before the rooster crows twice, you will deny me three times.' And he broke down and wept." So, do you think Peter was scared? He had followed Jesus all the way into the inner courtroom of the high priest, and he's watching what's going on. Very bold of Peter, right? But he's scared. Now notice in verse 66, Peter was below in the courtyard. One of the big soldiers of the high priest came. Is that what it says?
No.
What does it say? One of the servant girls, right? So Peter did not face the same interrogation Jesus just did. He faced a servant girl and some bystanders. Next slide. We see what happens. A rooster crows a second time, and Peter remembers Jesus' words, "You will deny me three times." So kids, what happened when the rooster crowed a second time?
Peter remembered,
right? So you'd think after that first time denying Jesus, he might have felt a little convicted or whatever. But when that rooster crowed that second time, that's when he remembered Jesus' words, "You will deny me three times." Yes, I did. And he broke down and wept. And imagine how Peter felt. Not only has Jesus, his closest friend, been arrested and put on trial, not only did Peter run in the garden, but he now denied his king three times in front of a servant girl. And all the arguments the disciples have had over who knows how long, over who is the greatest, Peter knows in his heart it's definitely not him. Next slide. What does this mean for us? This is a lot of familiar story, but if we don't apply it to our lives, we're just reading a story. Jesus warns his disciples to stay awake in the garden, to watch and pray so they do not fall into temptation. And yet they ran away and left Jesus. It is true for us today, the spiritual battle is often won or lost before crisis comes. I've been thinking about that all week. So often we expect, oh, I'll be strong when I face that battle or that crisis or temptation. But yet I haven't prepared myself for that if I haven't been praying for it. Right? I need to stay spiritually awake and be praying so when it comes, I'm ready. Think of the different ways Peter and Jesus faced their enemies. Remember the big group showing up? Do we, like Peter, try to take matters in our own hands? The sword was his way of conquering, right? He's the first one to draw the sword out and strike someone. Or do we, like Jesus, pray, "Not what I will, but what you will"? Surrendering to his Father's will was his way of conquering, right? Well, that doesn't make any sense, does it? You're going to conquer sin and death by being conquered yourself? But yet, that was God's plan, and he was willing to fight that way, by surrender, versus drawing a sword. Thanks, Oscar. Are we willing to follow in Jesus' footsteps and endure false claims against us, mocking and suffering? Right? It might not happen physically in this country yet, but we do face this kind of thing in our workplaces, in schools, wherever we go. We will experience suffering for being a follower of Christ. And are we willing to follow Jesus despite that? Lastly, how often do we deny Jesus like Peter did in our thoughts, words, and actions? And we talked about this a little last week, but how often are we quick to point at Peter and be like, you doofus, you denied your Lord three times, but yet in that same day, I might have done it in my thoughts or words or actions as well, even more than three times. And we need to be careful not to be haughty and think of ourselves better than Peter. Because I think ourselves in that same spot, we would have crumbled as well. May we be willing to humble ourselves and repent before our King. And may we joyfully receive his forgiveness and worship him with everything that we have. Right? That's the good news. We don't have to stop and be like, woe is me, I'm going to sin, I'm going to fail, I'm going to be as bad as Peter was. No, there is good news. There was good news for Peter, which we will learn more later. But there's good news for us as well. And we can walk confidently in knowing he will forgive us our sins. He does send the Holy Spirit to convict us, to help us, to make us more Christ-like. So my last slide is a quote from Charles Spurgeon. And he says, how earnestly, next, ought we to honor our dear Lord? If men were so eager to put him to shame, let us be 10 times more earnest to bring him glory. Is there anything we can do today by which he may be honored? Let us set about it. Can we make any sacrifice? Can we perform any difficult task which would glorify him? Let us not deliberate, but at once do it with our might. Let us be inventive in modes of glorifying him, even as his adversaries were ingenious in the methods of his shame. So, Don's going to come up, and we are going to sing praise to our Lord, and we are going to worship him with all our might.